So I did get tracking numbers for that thing. So I think it'll arrive like soon, today or tomorrow. Questions? So a Hilbert space is a vector space that has an inner product. An inner product is basically just a dot product.
And when you say it has an inner product, what do you mean? Like it?
So you can define it.
Okay.
So for n tuples, you know, like this, there's always been basically a dot product. But there's no reason a priori for a vector space to have a dot product, mathematically. But, I mean, all of our vectors in physics have always had dot products.
What am I talking about? A dot product meaning like it's like non-zero? Or is it, like it has to be defined as a the product? Like the two vectors, like...
So a dot product is something that takes two vectors and gives you a number.
Yeah,
and the problem was like if you had complex numbers, you could get a number that's less than zero for the magnitude.
Unless you did this complex conjugation stuff.
Yeah, unless you sort of change the definition.
Like, as far as like, is it, it has a dot product like non-zero or a zero store, or is it like the size of the vector?
No, it's just that you can define a dot product.
Okay.
There are vector spaces that you can't define a dot product for. So for example, mathematically, you can take Larry, Moe, and Curly and take a linear combination of them, and it's a perfectly good vector space. But, you know, what's the dot product of three? So it's mathematically, an inner product is an extra relation. But every vector space that we've had in physics has kind of come automatically with the dot product. So it may not seem like anything special, but to a mathematician, you know, they only have so many famous dead mathematicians, so they have to find a name to go with every one of them.
So, like an electric field is a vector space would be considered a Hilbert space then?
So everything we've done in physics would be considered a Hilbert space. So those are real Hilbert spaces where we only have real number entries, and there's nothing wrong with real Hilbert spaces, but typically when people are studying Hilbert spaces, they're complex. Certainly in physics, all of them are complex. So believe it or not, I mean, the mathematicians care about vector spaces over really odd fields, you know, like the prime roots of unity, where you p-tuples and things like that, clock arithmetic fields. So, I mean, only things we care about in physics are pretty much real numbers and complex numbers. So in some sense, from a physics perspective, the only thing that's new here is now our n-tuples have complex number entries, not just real number entries. And then in order to make something that that is positive for the length of a vector, then we have to use the complex conjugation. It may be also worth commenting that, I mean, one of the reasons mathematicians spend a lot of time on this, which we're not going to do, is to show that all of these properties that we're just taking over from finite dimensional Hilbert spaces follow through for infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So there is some heavy lifting to be done, but not by me. More questions. So the mathematicians actually make a big deal between the difference between a normal old column vector and a row vector. And so they invent what's called dual space, which is basically the vector space of the bras as opposed to the cats, and then start to derive properties about the dual space. But I mean, it really is just the same thing, transposed and complex conjugated. So from a physics perspective, it doesn't seem like it's worth spending a lot of time on. But in fact, it does seem that this difference maybe should amount to nothing. But it is a useful difference. And the difference between psi and psi star seems pretty much like epsilon, but it will be useful to distinguish the bras and the cats occasionally. So we've got eigenvectors and eigenvalues, the Hermitian adjoint, which for finite matrices is just the Hermitian conjugate, which is the transpose complex conjugate. Our book's gonna use this tilde for the transpose, which probably no one else besides Griffith is gonna use. Most people would use an uppercase T as a superscript for that. But we're not gonna have much just transpose, so it's okay to be using kind of a funny symbol for it. If we have a linear operator and we have a basis, then we have a matrix that represents how that operator operates and works nicely in that if we take the matrix that represents T times the matrix that represents S, then we get the matrix that represents S times T. So there's a homeomorphism, if we use the big mathematics word, between the matrices and the corresponding linear algebras, corresponding linear operators. An important factoid, of which we've proved pieces of, is that the eigenvectors of a Hermitian matrix are orthonormal. The piece that we didn't bother to prove is if we had the degenerate case, if we had two distinct eigenvalues, two distinct eigenvectors that had the same eigenvalue, which is to say that this polynomial has a double root. And it's not a big deal. You can use the Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization procedure, which is described in the book, but it's kind of difficult to describe and actually pretty simple. So we'll always assume that you can select your eigenvectors to be orthogonal. We showed that the eigenvalues were real. That was pretty quick. The fact that they span space is actually a pretty complicated proof, and we're just going to be assuming that. If we have different bases, then we can get different matrices that represent the same operator. And turns out that in the new basis, the matrix is just a similarity transform from the original basis. And this S matrix will be unitary if these bases were orthonormal to start with. If we select a basis that are the eigenvectors, then the resulting matrix will be diagonal for that Hermitian operator. And we looked at the trace and the determinant, the set of eigenvalues. All of those are invariant under the similarity transform, and so they are basis-independent properties of the operator. We won't have much use for the words symmetric and orthogonal, but you should probably be familiar with those terms. In three-dimensional space, if you change the basis, then the resulting matrix is orthogonal. And it's also unitary because because the matrix has to be real for normal real space. But orthogonal matrices, being real matrices, are kind of a subset of the unitary matrices. Questions? Well, we've got one kind of bit of, I would say, mathematics, except the mathematicians don't make much use of it. And so I don't think I can call it part of the review. And that's dyadics. And we talked about these in E&M. They're simply ways of representing matrices that are, maybe a little bit simpler. So if I just put two vectors next to each other, no dot, no cross, no nothing, what I mean is the matrix that is the following. So every row has the same thing of A, and every column has the same thing of B. I might make a mistake. And this matrix, if you think about it, has the nice property that if I take some vector and multiply it on the right, what I'm going to get for that first entry is going to be ax times b dot v. And what I'm going to get for that next entry is going to be ay times b dot v. And in fact, b dot v is going to be a common factor, so what I get is the vector a times b dot v. And it works the same if you multiply on the left, right? So it turns out that if I put a row vector over here and do this multiplication out, what I'm going to get is just going to be a constant times b. Okay, so this turns out to be a convenient way to represent matrices and the moment of inertia tensor and the stress tensor from last year, all could be written kind of nicely in terms of dyadics. Now, I think dyadics are considered a little bit old-fashioned. Good old Willie Gibbs, he's the guy who came up with these just before 1900, and I'm not sure exactly where I learned about them. I'm not sure that they were in our E&M book. I kind of introduced them. They have other names, but they're not great names. Outer product, but it turns out that mathematicians mean lots of different things by this name, outer product. So dyadics are an example of outer product, but there are lots of other examples. Tensor product. That's a good name for them. Turns out that one of the common way of making tensors in relativity is by the same process. But again, mathematicians often mean different things by tensor products. So I like Gibbs' original name, dyadic, because it, you know, sounds like something that there are two of, and there are, in fact, two things. A good name, which nobody in their right mind would use, is a cat bra. Because we'll see in a second that this thing is just the bracket written in the opposite of normal fashion. So it turns out I can write this object as a column vector of A times a row vector of B. And this is something that should look really kind of funny to your eyes, because matrix multiplication now is going to be very simple, right? So for the 1-1 entry of this matrix, there's just one thing, right? There's just BX times AX. And for the next one down, there's just one thing. So in fact, this thing here can be written as AB transpose. And in terms of bras and kets, what this is going to mean is that, right? So we can write a general linear transformation as something like this. So let T be a, and this is a shortcut of writing that same thing, right? I don't have to use all of the, has the same number of strokes, but it takes a lot less time to write. Right? Exactly the same thing as that. And this thing is defined so that if T operates on any vector V, what I want is the ket A multiplied by that, right? Well, let's take a look at some simple dyadics. So the dyadic that is the x direction I next to the x direction of I, if I take a normal sort of vector and do this process right, this is going to give me 1, this is going to give me 0, this is going to give me 0. So what I'm going to get in the end is this I times Vx. So what this operator does is it just gives me the x component of that vector. And if we If we think about what that does, on that same general vector, it's gonna throw out the z component, but otherwise it's gonna give me the same vector. Everyone believes that? So this by itself would give me vx in the I direction, and this thing by itself would give me vy in the j direction. So it's taking this thing and it's just throwing out the z component. And of course, I can go one step further. And if you think about it, that's the unit matrix, right? And if you're not convinced about it, just think about putting together these pieces, right? So this thing, the matrix that would represent this would be that. The matrix that would represent that would be, and so it goes. So if I put these three things together, I'm just going to get the unit matrix. So if you think about that more generally, the unit matrix can be written as a sum over any orthonormal basis. Because if I take any vector and multiply through by that, I'm going to get the same thing in the end. And this turns out to be a really handy trick in dealing with matrix operations. It might be nice to give particularly these guys a name. These things are called projection operators. And they have the property that once you throw out, in this particular case, once you throw out the z component, if you do it again, it doesn't change anything. Right? So in fact, a projection operator squared is the same thing as just projecting once. And it may be also useful to look at something that a Hermitian matrix. We can write a Hermitian matrix as having its eigenvalues down the diagonal, and what down the diagonal are is that. So writing matrices as dyadics, as I say, turns out to be a really handy notation that we'll use more than once. Okay, kind of questions about linear algebra, Appendix A sort of stuff. Okay, so back to chapter 3, back to some actual quantum mechanics. And most of what I'm going to say, I don't think is, at least to start with, is not going to be new, but we want to say it all once. So the claim of quantum mechanics is that any physical quantity you can think of. So for every physical quantity, I don't know, examples of physical quantities would be angular momentum, energy, momentum, position, any of those things that occurred in mechanics last semester, there exists a Hermitian operator that represents it. And we've already seen some examples of that, right? So for the position operator, it's just multiplication by x. For the momentum operator, it was h bar over I derivative with respect to x. With the Hamiltonian, it was the kinetic energy, which was just 2p squared over x times the energy. And we haven't gotten to things in three dimensions yet, but the angular momentum will still be r cross p, except p is now this operator. Now, well, okay, so let me say the next statement first. If you actually measure any of these physical quantities, then the only thing that you will ever detect is an eigenvalue. Okay, so if you go to measure the energy, the only things that you would measure would be the eigenenergies of the Hamiltonian. Now, I take it it goes without commenting that if your instrument doesn't have a lot of resolution, it may bunch a whole bunch of distinct eigenvalues and give you the same answer, right? You can think about kind of like a voltmeter that only has three digits, but maybe the variation in the eigenvalues is in the fifth digit. So it would lump together lots of different eigenvalues and give you, and read, the meter would read the same value. But if you got better resolution, in the end you would only see those distinct values. Now we know the main point of quantum mechanics is that things aren't deterministic, that there is probability that's involved. So if I take exactly the same system and make exactly the same measurement, I won't get, in general, exactly the same result. So what we need to find is the probability of finding a particular result. And that probability, all we need to do is to take the corresponding eigenvector, psi A, and do the integral with the wave function that describes that system. And in general, of course, we know this guy is going to depend on time. And then take the absolute magnitude of it squared. So let's say we're interested in finding the probability of finding a particular result that has some eigenvalue lambda A. Okay. So we take the psi that is the eigenvector that corresponds to that eigenvalue, and we do that integral and square the result, and that'll give us the probability of finding that particular result. Okay, so we've talked about this before in terms of energy, in terms of the Hamiltonian, which is actually the most measured quantity. But we claim that this is true for any old quantity. So there's nothing particularly special about the energy aspect of it. Okay, so let's be particular. Let's say we decide we want to measure the angular momentum, the angular momentum squared, the length of the angular momentum vector. So the first thing we do is we find the operator that represents the angular momentum, and we find its eigenvectors and values. No, it has nothing to do with the wave function. It has to do with this differential equation, right? So the angular momentum has derivatives in it. This is a differential equation, and I need to solve it to find what the eigenvectors and eigenvalues are. Okay. So let's say that I do this, and I find out that the only possible values are 0, 1, and 2, just to give a short list. So 2 corresponds to some particular function, psi 2. 1 corresponds to some particular function, psi 1. Psi 0 corresponds to some particular function, psi 0. Okay, so all of this just looks like differential equations.
So that's invariant for any sort of set of
Say again?
That sort of, like if you did find the solutions, that differential equation would be invariant for any setup that you have because it's just the operator.
It's just the operator. So it doesn't depend on how you've arranged your equipment.
Okay.
So the only possible values for angular momentum could be determined by a mathematician. So once we know the only possible values for the angular momentum, we want to know the probability of getting those particular results. So if we want to find the probability that we would measure angular momentum to, we would take this wave function, and we would take the actual wave function of our system under consideration, and we do that integral and square the results, and we get the probability. Okay, so what we were doing last time, we were dealing with the energies. And we said if you wanted to find the probability that you would measure one of these particular energies, we did this process. And we could calculate the average value of those results, of course, just by taking those probabilities times those values. So all we're really claiming is what we said about energy is true of any operator. That there's nothing particularly special about the energy operator. All of them work the same way. I don't know, so without this absolute value, let me call this thing CA. And what we know is that this function can be expanded with those exact coefficients times the eigenvectors of whatever operator we've chosen. And that just says that the eigenfunctions of an operator span the space. And so we could expand any old function in terms of those guys. Now, these guys don't depend on time. This thing in general does depend on time. So these expansion coefficients will depend on time. In general. And what I would invite you to think about is that this wave function, the information of that wave function, is just as much contained in those coefficients as it is in, you know, the polynomial or whatever that represents psi double bar. So those CAs basically are like coordinates of a vector. So this guy here represents the state of the function, and we can express the state of the function in this coordinate system or that coordinate system just by choosing different operators to expand, to use whose eigenvectors we can use as basis vectors for that space. Okay, so abstractly, you can think about this guy. This is the thing that represents the system. It's a vector that's moving around in some arbitrary fashion. And if we want to know what the probabilities are for any measurement, we choose a basis for the space that this guy is rotating around with. And the expansion coefficients, when squared, tell us the probability of the corresponding thing being measured. So these coordinates are just like this vector. They have exactly the same information. And just as a vector can be expressed in lots of different coordinate systems, we could choose a different operator, get a different set of eigenvectors, get a different set of coefficients, but it's all the same vector. Okay, so this is a little bit more abstract way of thinking about it. So this thing is the state vector. It describes the state of the system. And we're used to thinking about this as some ugly time-dependent polynomial in X. But we could just as well think about it as these time-dependent coefficients of the basis that we have chosen for this Hilbert space.
Choose the CMs to like contain it in a basis.
Yeah, so I don't, we don't exactly choose them. So just like if I have a vector this way and I choose x and y coordinates, I mean, they're determined, right, by that vector. If I choose a rotated coordinate system, then those c's would be determined by that rotated coordinate system. So what I choose to have as a basis, what I choose to use as a coordinate system is, you know, kind of up for grabs. If I use a coordinate system that's based on angular momentum, then the expansion coefficients will tell me the probability of measuring those various values of angular momentum. If I decide to use a basis that's based on energy, then the corresponding coordinates will tell me the probability of getting various energy states. What is special about the Hamiltonian is that it determines how that thing changes in time, right? So this abstract vector is moving around in time, and that equation tells us the time dependence of psi. So in general, these expansion coefficients are going to be changing, you know, in kind of arbitrary expressions as this vector moves around in space. What is particularly nice if we choose the basis that is the energy basis is we've shown, so this is, if I now particularize this so that these are energy eigenfunctions, then we know that the time dependence is really simple. You can just tack on these e to the minus I omega t's. But if you choose a different basis, then the time dependence of those c's is going to be, you know, weird and wonderful.
So to choose an energy basis, the state vectors have to be basically in the forms of what the energies are.
Yeah, but it's really more general than that. If I choose a basis based on operator Q, then the expansion coefficients tell me the probability of measuring any eigenvalue of Q. And of course, if the system is changing in time, those probabilities are going to be changing in time, but typically in a kind of ugly fashion. If we choose a basis that's based on the energy eigenfunctions, then those probabilities don't depend on time because it's magnitude of that squared, and the exact formula for psi is pretty easily written down just by tacking on those time dependencies.
So the energy is just prettier than most of them.
Say again?
The energy one is just prettier than most of them.
Yeah, but hugely, hugely prettier. So if I basically if I choose anything except energy, it will be a huge mess to calculate how these things depend on time. And we will never write down a formula for how they depend on time. We'll make kind of Taylor series expansions for how they depend on time. But for energy, boy, it's hard to imagine how it could be much simpler. The whole probability won't depend on time, and the amplitude will just have this phase factor that is going to be different because omega is going to be different for different eigenvalues, but is pretty simple.
What would be other things?
Anything you might want to measure, right? So angular momentum, momentum position, anything you might want to measure, you could choose that basis and then figure out what the probabilities would be for that measurement.
So
you choose it to be the eigenvectors of whatever you want to measure. So say you want to measure the physical quantity SAM. So SAM would have a differential equation for it. And this is kind of the surprising thing, that this bit of mathematics kind of determines everything. You think about how a voltmeter works and has lots of particularities, right? It's got resistors, capacitors, all sorts of stuff in it. But somehow or other, all of those possibilities are encoded in this differential equation. So you measure SAM, excuse me, you know what the differential equation is for SAM, you solve for the eigenvectors, and then you do this integral with a particular eigenvector, and you get the corresponding probability of measuring that SAM is 6, So you'd put in psi 6 to figure out what the probability of measuring Sam equals 6 is. It seems kind of too good to be true that, as I say, that this differential equation has much to do with how measuring angular momentum in the lab, right, which would involve using stopwatches and things like that. It's hard to see any connection between the stopwatches and this differential equation. But that's the way it works. More questions?
So we use that energy equation to write the wave function because it's the easiest and gives us the most useful results.
So the Hamiltonian is useful for lots of reasons. So first of all, it turns out that people are usually interested in energy, that it is by far the most interesting physical quantity to measure. Not only that, turns out that the Hamiltonian determines the future of that state. And not only that, but if we choose that Hamiltonian basis, then these probabilities have this particularly simple form. So the Hamiltonian is special for those three reasons. Questions.
So if you wanted to measure like momentum, but h bar over I, the partial is for like x, how would you set up that differential equation?
So it's a pretty simple differential equation, right? So, there's kind of a notational problem which the book sometimes solves by distinguishing the number that is the momentum from the operator that was the momentum by putting like a caret on top of it. And sometimes that's useful or not. So what I want is that operator operating on some one wave function gives me a number. This is the number now, times psi. And so this is a differential equation that minus h bar over I derivative with respect to x of psi is equal to p times psi. And that's a simple differential equation, right? Psi prime over psi is going to be minus I p divided by h bar, and that tells us that psi is equal to e to the minus I p x divided by h bar. Okay, so it's all just mathematics, right? Here is a differential equation. I solve that differential equation and get that answer. I guess I have the sign wrong, plus p. So once I have these eigenfunctions, and I know what my system is, I do this integral, and I get the probability of measuring whatever value of p I'm talking about. So if I want to find the probability that the momentum is 5, I put in 5 is equal to p, and I do this integral, and I get that. And when I square that integral, I get the probability of finding the momentum is 5. More questions? Okay, so there's a fly in the ointment. And I don't know if it was evident in what I just said, but it's present in what I just previously said. And that is, how do we deal with continuous spectra eigenvectors, right? So remember I said the probability that a particle in this room has a velocity that's pi is 0. So what I said literally can't be true, right? The probability that the particle has momentum 5 is 0. What I really need is the probability density that the momentum is near 5. Right? Just because these things are continuous as opposed to being discrete. So we've got some work to do when we're talking about continuous eigenvectors. How are we going to deal with this? And I don't know, there are lots of ways of kind of getting at this, but I don't know, I always like to think about things in terms of units. What's going to be going on kind of unit-wise? So here we were talking about a discrete probability, and we said that the probability of measuring value A, that was that expansion coefficient squared. And that probability had to be a number. But if we're talking about a continuous case, you know, say the probability that we measure some momentum P, then we have to get a probability density, the probability that it's in a bin. So this thing better be a probability per bin size, right? Per momentum. So if we get different units for these equations, it must be that the units of psi are going to be different whether we're talking about a continuous eigenvector that belongs to a continuous set, or talking about an eigenvalue that belongs to a discrete set. And I don't know, that should strike you as pretty weird, right? Because electric fields have the units of electric fields. They don't depend on the circumstance. So now I'm telling you that the units of psi depends on the circumstance. What we've been mostly talking about are cases where psi had the units of 1 over the square root of length, because what was required is this integral be exactly 1, right? So here we had the units of length, so we needed to have the units of 1 over length in order to get something that was unitless. So how are we going to work this when we have continuous eigenvalues? Well, let's back up a little bit of step. Really what we had here in the discrete case was that, right? We had a Kronecker delta. If n equals m, we got 1. If n didn't equal m, we got 0. What are we going to do when we have continuous eigenvectors? And if you think about it, kind of the only thing really that's going to make sense is to have a Dirac delta function. So if I take two wave functions that correspond to different momenta, I'm going to require that the orthogonality, it's 0 if p doesn't equal p prime, but it's going to be a Dirac delta function in general.
What was the Dirac delta function defined again?
So the Dirac delta function was defined to be 0 if its argument isn't 0, and so infinite if its argument is 0 so that the area under it is 1. So the oneness that we have with the 1/0-ness that we have with the Kronecker delta is carried over to the 1/0-ness of the delta function, but in a kind of an integral sort of way. And I don't know, that should kind of make some sense if we sum for all m Kronecker delta of 5m, we're going to get 1. And now the equivalent statement, if we integrate delta of 5 minus p prime dp prime, right? That's the same. Here we're summing over states. Here we're summing over states. We're still going to get 1, right? Because p is going to equal 5 at some point. So they're similar but different. And one of the important respects that they're different is the units. So we've said lots of times that every function on your calculator, it wants to eat a argument that is unitless, and it wants to produce an argument that's unitless. And using those tricks, we're able to figure out what the units are of various equations. Well, Dirac delta is not a function on your calculator, so new rules apply. So the units of delta of q, where q is some quantity, what are the corresponding units? And of course, what must be the same, what must be true, is the integral of q dq better be equal to 1. So that means that the units of this are going to be 1 over q. So the upshot of all of this is that these continuous wave functions are going to have, they have the units of square root of L in order to cancel the dx. And they're also going to have q in the denominator to match the units that we have of that thing. Okay, so, and all of this is required so that psi star psi, so that this integral gives us a probability density as opposed to just a probability. We need to have this Dirac delta function normalization as opposed to the Kronecker delta normalization. Okay, so is this confusing or not? I don't know. It makes it mathematically noticeably more difficult. So momentum would be a great example of this, right? So what we said is that h bar over I, derivative with respect to x, this thing is what the book would call the momentum operator. When that thing operates on one of its eigenvectors, it's going to give me the eigenvalue times that wave function back. So this p here is a real number. It has to be real because the p operator is a Hermitian matrix. And I don't know, there are a lot of p's there. So it can get confusing and maybe a little bit ugly. Instead of dealing with the p operator, let's start by operating with the wave number operator. All right, so we've had these wave numbers k for a long time, right? They're 2 pi over the wavelength, and we know that the momentum is closely related to the k operator. And it's going to be just a little bit easier then to deal with the eigenfunctions of this thing where this k that we're talking about is going to be a number. And this is a simple differential equation. It's easy to solve. Psi k is going to be equal to e to the I kx. But I have to normalize that wave function. And in the past, what normalization would mean is that psi star psi integrated to 1. But that can't happen, right? Because psi star psi is 1. And if I integrate it over all space, I'm guaranteed to get infinity. So what I need is a normalization constant so that psi k prime complex conjugated psi k dx is a delta function of k minus k prime. So if I plug and chug, what I've got is the magnitude of n squared, the integral of e to the I k minus k prime x dx. Yeah, I don't know if you remember it or not, but one formula for the delta function is as follows. 1 over 2 pi, the integral of e to the I, whatever you put here, in this case it's k minus k prime, dx. So evidently, the magnitude of n squared wants to be 1 over 2 pi. So that's what I can use for my now normalized wave functions. What's the probability density of finding a particular value of k? Well, what I'm supposed to do is to take the overlap integral of that k thing with my original function. So that's going to be 1 over the square root of 2 pi, the integral of e to the minus ikx psi dx. And so this is the thing that we might call ck, the probability density. When squared, it would give us the probability density that we would find a particular value of k. And of course, I should be able to write the original wave function as a sum of those ck multiplied by the corresponding psi k. This would be an integral over k. And so just add up all the wave functions times the corresponding ck. I don't know. Do you see that this is just Fourier transform? And so we take the, start here, take the, this is, these CKs are the coefficients that give us psi, and we can figure out these CKs by doing that. It's exactly Fourier transforms. Well, what happened to my unit argument? So I claimed that the units of psi had to be the units of whatever quantity I was talking about times the units of length. Well, the units of k are inverse length. So that's why we don't see anything unitless in here. If I play the same game, and it works exactly the same way, except I have to inverse some h-bars, then this psi p will be 1 over the square root of 2 pi h-bar times e to the I px divided by h-bar. And of course, h-bar has the units of momentum times length, right? Just exactly what it needed to have. The corresponding probability of density of finding some value k, well, I really want to have p's, so this would be px divided by h-bar, and that wave function would be an h-bar. So the corresponding quantity, which our book denotes as phi of p, that's sometimes called the momentum, the wave function in the momentum basis. Okay, or the momentum eigenfunction. And I guess I've gone as far as I'm allowed to go. Okay, so the upshot is that continuous eigenvalues, sums are going to become integrals, psi is going to change its units. It's all kind of a mess. But it should all look kind of the same if we just kind of squint carefully.